Welcome to episode 22 for February 27th, 2007, approximately 5 a.m. in the morning Eastern Standard Time. And we got some interesting things for you on this week's show, such as our reactions to the winners of the Oscars that were just last Sunday. And so we'll tell you what surprised us, what we liked, what we didn't like, and also announce the winners of the contest that we've been running. And, of course, we'll have a trivia question, as always. And then a film spotlight on a pretty interesting movie from the late 70s called A Bridge Too Far. It was a British production and quite a big production. It tells a story that takes place during World War II. And our top six list of this week is movies where the particular version you see is important. And wrapping things up, a good bad movie about Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. I am Sam Stoddard.
I'm Stephen Keller, and I got to tell you, I'm thrilled to finally be doing episode 22. It seems like it's been so long that I've been waiting for this moment. I mean, everywhere I go to the doctor, I go to the butcher, I go get an x-ray. People are saying to me, Stephen, you should do episode 22. And I'm just so excited. Finally, I'd like to just thank everyone from my agent to myself for making it all possible. Thank you. It's really great to finally accomplish this.
Stephen?
Yes, sir.
Stephen, your co-host, maybe?
Who?
Sam Stoddard.
Oh, I'd also like to thank Tam Tottard for his effort. I don't know exactly what it is. Anyway, he's great. He's great. He's awesome. Thanks a lot.
So the Oscars are over. This is our recap. Talk about some last things. Now we'll know the results before we put the subject to rest for another year. But, Stephen, so you're pretty happy right now, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I sure am. I was a big fan of The Departed. This is pretty much the first time I can remember that my favorite movie of the year actually won the Oscar.
Yeah.
I haven't seen all of them, so maybe there's something I'm missing. Probably there is, but I love The Departed, and I love Scorsese, so I'm stoked.
Yeah, and there have been Best Picture winners that I think this has been your favorite of the year, as we've talked about in the Best Of series, that if you missed that, you should definitely go check that out. That was something that seemed to be pretty popular with people. But, yeah, the first time in recent memory, I think, that the best movie has won. I mean, I guess I can definitely get behind Return of the King, but I don't know. This wasn't an immediate, obvious choice, necessarily. It's a real horse race, a real race to the finish in Best Picture. And, of course, director. I mean, what a moment there. You got Spielberg and Lucas and Coppola on stage at the same time to present Martin Scorsese's Oscar. And, you know, it's kind of funny. You can tell they were expecting this, but they're kind of setting themselves up for failure. The Trip that we've mentioned on the show before was talking to me in the chat on Oscar night. You know, what if they get these three guys up there to welcome their friend into the, you know, and then it turns out to be Stephen Frears or somebody, and the Oscar goes to, oh yeah. But, yeah, what interesting moment. So, ceremony-wise, we'll just talk about a couple of things real quick. I was very surprised that Al Gore seemed to be the highlight of the thing. Certainly not a highlight with me, just in general. Of course, he was up there with Leo DiCaprio, and DiCaprio was trying to urge him to make a major announcement, because there was all this speculation that he might be announcing his bid for the presidency at the Oscars in front of a billion people, you know, and it was kind of a strange thing to do. But so they got to joking about it, and he said, well, now that you mention it, and he pulls out a thing, says, my fellow Americans, I would like to formally announce my intention to, and then he got cut off by the orchestra. It was very, very appropriate. Other moments that you'd like maybe during the ceremony, Stephen?
Yeah, well, we were talking about it ourselves right before the show started. The bit with Ellen in the audience, those were great, really inspired. You know, her trying to get Spielberg to take her picture, and then do you know how to do this, and then asking him to get a little more on the edges, critiquing his photography. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, and of course there was a lot of a gentle play with people's personalities. Sometimes it's a little more cutting. You know, Chris Rock was a very sarcastic sort of host, and Ellen was just nice. I was not expecting to like her, actually. I think her voice is just too shrieky and whiny for me or something like that. I just don't get her comedy, but I think she's did one of the better jobs in recent years. And but she'd say things like, you know, a lot of diversity we have, and cite a number of the Asian and Black nominees, and Steve Carell, you know, a lot of diversity. And Steve Carell's in the audience, kind of just looking around. And in the Oscar chat on Rink, where somebody didn't get the joke, and I didn't know how to explain it. It's just one of those things.
It's like Footloose or Flashdance. You had to get it or you don't. Can I comment on one aspect of the production I really liked, though?
Okay.
When they presented the award for editing and the way that they showed the various the clips from each movie that was being nominated, they showed in one screen, you know, the scene that the audience saw, and then above it, in little boxes, they had the various other shots the editors had to work with, and kind of showed how it was just a real neat illustration of how editors work, in a sense where they have, you know, a couple different shots that they can choose from, and as the main screen cut between it, you still saw all four images running at the same time. I thought that was a really neat neat bit. I don't know if anyone else noticed it, but I was really blown away by how cool that was for just a brief moment.
Yeah, that was excellent. And I also thought they did a pretty good job with the screenplay awards, just narrating a little bit of the screenplay so you can see a scene and then hear how it was written. And so there's a, it's not always obvious when you read a screenplay how it's going to finally look, or vice versa. And it was kind of neat to see the both at the same time. Some others were less illuminating, but I really liked that sound effects choir. That was something. So what do you think, we should mention foreign language film, of course, we were talking on this show about how it's got to be Pan's Labyrinth, but there was Amelie that missed it. And the common denominator between the two movies is it was the highest profile foreign language nominee, and also had a lot of other nominations. So obviously it's going to win, right? And of course it didn't. It was The Lives of Others. And Pan's Labyrinth actually took home 3 Oscars in technical categories. And no other movie got more than that except The Departed with 4. But I was thinking, you know what, this is going to happen, because The Lives of Others, although it's not as much visibility as Pan's Labyrinth, is really seems to be loved just as much, and Pan's Labyrinth can be awarded in other categories, so maybe they'll pick this one to give to The Lives of Others. I thought of all of this before it started, and then I didn't switch, because I was too afraid of switching 2 guesses and having both of them wrong. The one I did switch was for a short film, and that I had right the first time, so a lot of terror. I'm kind of frustrated with myself, even though I did all right. I had 15 correct out of 24, normally not a good score, but it was good enough in this unpredictable year to place 8th on our little contest. I wasn't competing for the prizes, obviously, just for the fun of it. But Stephen, what did you think? What was the surprises that you had?
Well, I mean, Pan's Labyrinth, obviously a huge surprise.
Yeah.
I think Alan Arkin kind of coming from behind to win supporting actor, that's kind of surprising, because it wasn't but a couple months ago that it didn't seem like likely at all that he was going to pull it off. But, you know, he had momentum building as it went into it. I think picture and director were both kind of surprising, too. Maybe not director. I really felt it was going to be Scorsese's year this year. But
yeah, me
too. Picture, I felt like it was up in the air the whole time. You know, once The Departed started picking up awards and seemed like it had some traction, but I don't know, there wasn't an overwhelming, obvious, huge walk-away winner this year like there is in some years. It really feels like a very diverse year in terms of what was nominated and what won. I was surprised by how few Oscars Babel ended up winning.
Yeah, just one score, and that was it. I was actually expecting it to win editing as well. I kind of knew, I guess The Departed for Best Picture, like you did, and I kind of knew it had it in the bag when the editing went to The Departed instead of Babel. It was going to be one of the two. And when it went to The Departed, I thought, okay, well, now that's looking good for The Departed.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Children of Men should have won editing, but I don't think I know anything about editing, because the one I want to win editing has never actually won editing. So,
well, you know, from all I've heard of Children of Men, it seems like it should have won cinematography. That was the one that threw me.
Yeah, but I haven't seen Pan's Labyrinth, so I from what people are saying about it, it doesn't seem like that's much of a stretch, but I'd like to. But yeah, Children of Men also, incredibly well-filmed, great-looking film as well. I mean, technically just amazing. I wish it would have got a little bit more love than it did, but it doesn't seem like there's anything horrendous this year at all. Nothing I'm really angry about.
I tell you one thing, best song. I think there's one Melissa Etheridge song that I like. This one is her screaming. You know, I would rather any of the other four to win. Yes, even Randy Newman. I don't have the dislike for him that you do, but definitely all three Dreamgirl songs were so much better. And obviously, I think they, in retrospect, they just split their votes, and that's what happened there. There have been other times, two other times, when one movie got three Best Song nominees, and each time they both won, and this time it didn't happen. But you can kind of see how it happened. I mean, Inconvenient Truth and the whole green thing was obviously a moment of pride with the Academy this year. So you can kind of see how it happened. But it's just disappointing, because if you just take the song as a song, I think it was terrible. It was the worst of the five.
I don't think I've ever been happy with Best Song, so I don't even really care at this point.
That's true, yeah.
The Academy just nominates and awards performers they like, I think, rather than these songs. So,
yeah.
You know, they like Melissa Etheridge, so it was her turn to win.
I meant to mention, back when we were talking about Spielberg and Lucas and Coppola on screen, is it just me, or is that the best thing Lucas has done in 10 years? Allow himself to be the butt of the joke there, that he's the one that hasn't won the Oscar on the stage.
No kidding.
That was excellent of him. I actually gained a lot of respect for him.
Of course, we should note that Lucas has directed like 5 movies in his life. So
Right. He's certainly better known as a producer.
I mean, even when you think of his best movie, Empire Strikes Back, he didn't direct that.
Right. Yeah.
Can Scorsese win another Oscar? The guy's still productive and pretty prolific.
I don't know. Maybe he will. Maybe the curse is broken and they'll be fine. Or maybe they'll just think, well, we gave it to him. Let's give it to somebody else.
Yeah, we'll see. What I'd be interested to see is what kind of movies he makes. Because clearly this is a guy who really, really, really wanted to win. You know, you get the feeling with some other directors, they don't really care as much, but I think Scorsese really wanted this, and it kind of influenced. I mean, clearly a movie like Gangs of New York or The Aviator, where everyone sort of said, well, this is an attempt to grab Oscar. So is he just going to go back to making gangster movies, or?
Well, that's what he's done. I mean, The Departed is that. I don't think he was really going for an Oscar with that one. It's hard to know if he made Gangs of New York and The Aviator to win, or if there was just a happy coincidence of agendas there. I suspect the answer is not very simple, but we know he intends to continue working with Leonardo DiCaprio for the next 12 or 15 years, so he says. And I think probably Scorsese's movies have pulled out DiCaprio's best performances, and that's actually saying a lot. He had a phase in there around Titanic and after where he was seen as just a pretty boy, but before Titanic he actually had quite a respectable acting career with What's Eating Gilbert Grape and a number of other things. So I hope he continues to do well too. So well, wrapping things up, we got to talk about the prizes, because we had a predictions game and we had a good 400 people competing in the Academy Awards predictions game on Rinkworks. It's a good number, and certainly happy to have all of you. However, only about 45 of you actually registered with the All Movie Talk code, which is a good amount for a new podcast, but a lot of people throwing away chances at prizes, including the top three people who all did better than our first place winner of for the prizes, and that was coming in at number 4 with 16 correct guesses and a pretty good deal with the tiebreakers there. But it's Jebediah, and I recognize that name from scoring well in past contests, and now he's done it on a year that'll get him some things. So he's already been in contact with us through email and selected the movies he wants to receive, and what are they, Dr. Strangelove and Rear Window, I think. And we'll also be sending him a copy of Sidney Lumet's book, Making Movies. And our second place winner is actually a regular at the allmovietalk.com website. And this is a good time to remind you all to go there, because you should listen to what she has to say. She's actually a very wonderful contributor to the website, always has something interesting to say, but I don't know how to pronounce the nickname. Do you have any idea?
I'm guessing Cio Cembio?
See, now, when I see that, I see school subjects, chemistry and biology. I don't know what the Cio is or the CO or whatever, but it's Cio Chembio to rhyme it. So maybe she could let us know how to pronounce her username. Anyway, you get second place, and I haven't heard from you yet, but email us and tell us what movie you want off that list of 10 that we posted way back, and we'll also send you a copy of the book. And another copy of the book is going to Automator, who graced us with his presence in the Oscar chat, and we were happy to have him there. And so you'll get a copy of the book. And so congratulations to all three of you. Well, we come to another trivia question, as we have virtually every week. It's the best part of the show, I've heard from many people who've written in named Sam. The question for this week is, what star holds the record in the Guinness Book of World Records for receiving the most fan mail? Think about that one. Who could possibly be such a huge star as to get the most fan mail of anybody? And we'll get back to you later on in the episode. In 1944, the Allies had a plan to deal World War II a death blow. About 3 Gagillion paratroopers would drop behind enemy lines in Holland and move up the Rhine River, seizing control of a series of bridges on the way. Initially, this is a successful plan, and they capture one bridge after another and mostly hold off enemy forces until they get to the last crucial bridge, the one at Arnhem, where things just fall apart. Losses were bad on both sides, but the Allies are beaten and must withdraw. This operation was the last major German victory during the war. Well, this story is told as a riveting epic movie in A Bridge Too Far, released in 1977, and it does an admirable job of keeping this pretty complex narrative straight for us, because it wasn't quite as simple as I made it sound. There were many different Allied divisions coordinating each other on this operation, depending on that coordination, and planning to converge at key times to help each other out. There aren't a lot of spectacular battle scenes of the kind we've become accustomed to seeing ever since Saving Private Ryan, but you do definitely get a feel for the intensity and the desperation of the different wartime situations the movie shows us. For the most part, we key in on the commanding officers of different divisions coordinating together, but we also occasionally touch base with the common soldiers and a personal story here and there. The film was directed by Richard Attenborough, who has directed 11 films to date, including Gandhi and A Chorus Line, and he has another one in production, so he's still working, but he is primarily known as an actor, starting his career way back in the 1940s. But probably what he's best known for now is the role of John Hammond, the man who masterminded the dinosaur theme park in Jurassic Park. But except for a quick cameo, he stays behind the camera in A Bridge Too Far, leaving the spotlight to an impressively huge ensemble cast of big names. We got Robert Redford, Sean Connery, Michael Caine, Laurence Olivier, Anthony Hopkins, Gene Hackman, Ryan O'Neill, Elian Gould, James Caan. The list goes on, but you get the idea. And this was probably a really good decision to go with so many recognizable faces because, I mean, well, besides that, these guys are just terrific to watch anyway, no matter what they're in. But because none of the characters could really be said to be main characters in this movie, they're all supporting characters, you know, none of them have huge parts because there's just so many. But I think this movie would be a lot harder to follow if we weren't already good at recognizing the faces in this movie and being quick to pick up on who is who.
Yeah, it's interesting, the all-star cast. It reminds me of a World War II movie I like a lot more than you, the 1998 film The Thin Red Line, in which we have an all-star cast, a more modern all-star cast, of course, but the characters are all indistinguishable, except for the fact that we already knew who half of them are going into it, so we recognize actors more than we recognize characters, which can be nice in war movies where everyone's covered in dirt and wearing the same uniform.
Right. There is another famous movie that does the same sort of thing that precedes both of those titles. It's the 1962 film The Longest Day, directed by Ken Annakin, and it's about D-Day. And it also gives us this broad overview of the operation, much like A Bridge Too Far does, telling us the story of many different factions, and it also uses an all-star cast. John Wayne, Robert Mitchum, Henry Fonda, Roddy McDowall, Richard Burton, Robert Wagner. Sean Connery's actually in both movies, but for the most part, you know, it's just that preceding generation's big names. But The Longest Day, I think it's the better film of the two, something of a classic, but they're both strong and make a great double feature if you see these two together. And sure, add on The Thin Red Line as a third if you like.
It would take you 2.5 days to watch all three of those movies back to back.
I think you're probably right. So let's talk about our favorite moments. I think maybe you and I have some of the same ones. I have 3 that are favorites, but before we do that, maybe talk about the weaker points. I think pretty much most of this movie is very strong, but 2 scenes in particular kind of disappointed me. One was Gene Hackman's role as the Polish Major General. He's not bad. He's a great actor, but I thought his role gave him really nothing to work with, and it was a little disappointing to see all these other great actors with great stuff to work with, and Hackman, I don't know, he really only ever gets to stand around in meeting rooms and be discontented with the way things are going.
Yeah, I was disappointed by that too, because I love him early on in the film when they're planning the operation, and then, you know, it's sort of the point that he gets kind of left beside, but it's disappointing that he gets so little to do later in the film when his early performance is kind of strong, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, but I suppose you can't give this many people really big scenes either. I don't know. My second weak moment, I think, is a little more of an irritant. It's the portrayal of Lieutenant General Frederick Browning, who is the key figure in getting this operation called Operation Market Garden underway. The acting by Dirk Bogarde is fine, but I think the screenplay does him an injustice for the sake of some cheap drama. In the movie, he's portrayed as this comfortable military officer and gets to be cavalier about implementing war plans and turn a blind eye to the suffering and the death that the men in the field endure to carry out his decisions. Movies love to paint high-ranking officers in this kind of light, but this is a simplistic caricature, and the reality, I think, is a lot more complicated. It really feels odd in this movie, which is comfortable with handling more complexity in other areas and doesn't otherwise push a political agenda. But the key scene that rubs me wrong is the last scene with him, where after the operation is over and, you know, it's failed, and Browning, who had up until now been confident in this plan, changes his story and says, "Well, as you know, I always felt we tried to go a bridge too far." That's where the name of the title comes from. It's because they captured all the bridges up to the last one, and that's where they failed. In reality, the real General Browning said this line during the planning of the operation, saying, "I think we may be going a bridge too far," and of course, he was right, but the movie moves that quote to the end and completely changes what it signifies, and unfortunately, the real Browning was not around to defend himself at the time, having died in 1965, so kind of a cheap shot that I think hurts the movie.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that character was weak, and yeah, the last scene, it would work if it were more fictional, if you're trying to make Browning into a bad character, but it does seem like a wrong thing to do to the memory of an actual person. The other scene that really bothers me, and I'm a little bit of a spoiler, it's the way the little Dutch kid is handled. As soon as I saw the movie introduce a 14-year-old Dutch boy who was, you know, acting as a spy for the Dutch underground, I knew his fate immediately, and true to form, the movie delivers it, and it's just, I don't know, something with the most obvious war cliché is really great on me, especially by 1977, where sort of the glory era of the World War II film is over. I don't know that we needed to reach for that cliché the way it resolves. I mean, I guess it's trying to be more moving, but in my mind, it's so telegraphed that it doesn't quite work for me.
Right, if you can see the manipulation coming, it's not as effective. Well, my purpose in doing this segment is actually to encourage people to see this movie. So now that we've gotten the bad stuff out of the way, let me talk about the good stuff and why it's worth seeing. I think the movie is strong 95% of the running time, somewhere in there. But as I said before, three key moments do stick out for me. And the first and strongest is the scene where the paratroopers dive out of the planes. This is an absolutely spectacular series of shots. It's hard to convey the impact of this in words. The camera does these extreme long shots of lines and lines of planes flying by and parachutes dropping out of each one at regular intervals, and they just choke the sky. It's a real spectacle, an incredible visceral scene, and striking too that, hey, in our modern age of big special effects extravaganzas, here's a movie from the 1970s, before computer animation and things like that, that really has that kind of power to it.
Yeah, and the great thing about that is, as I was watching that, all I could think was, how did they do that shot? Did they actually throw a bunch of people out of planes or what? Because I know that in 1977, they weren't using computers to fake it all. You know, if you saw it today, I would be absolutely certain that it would all be computer-generated, but it looks so impressive seeing all those figures in the sky and all those planes. It's a pretty amazing shot. My favorite moments in the film, though, aren't quite that impressive. It's just the general, about 45 minutes before we actually get to any combat, we get to watch the planning of the operation. And I think it's fascinating the way the movie shows us how the military can work sometimes and the danger of the groupthink that, you know, military discipline and chain of command causes in a way. I mean, you need that sort of discipline for the military to be effective, but it also is really bad when you have all these people who are working on this plan, and everyone can see that it's a terrible plan, and there are so many problems with it, you know, logistically, and it's obviously never going to work at all the way they expect it to, and it's way too complicated, but this is what Montgomery wants, and everyone's going to implement their orders, and no one really is able to fully express that they think it's a terrible idea and they shouldn't do it, because they have their orders and they're following it, and everyone tries to do it as best as they can, but it's just really interesting watching all these people who know that they're going to be leading troops into what they personally feel is a terrible idea and a bad situation.
Yeah, I agree. That was a really interesting sequence to watch. But going back to individual scenes, the second of my favorite scenes is a sequence in the middle of the movie, a whole sequence, not really a scene, concerning the character played by James Caan, who is this staff sergeant.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the few... So you agree this is a strong one, too. Okay. Well, he's one of the few characters who isn't a general or someone of that level. He's got this short story that's a very personal one. He makes a promise to a fellow soldier, and then it turns out that he has to do some pretty difficult things to keep it, including maneuvering a jeep around and or through an enemy patrol. And there's this fantastic tracking shot that moves alongside his jeep as he's steering it off the road and weaving it around these trees in the woods. So a real exciting scene. And when he gets to where he's going, which is a medical tent, the scene that occurs there, I'm not really sure I buy it. It feels a little like another one of these cheap dramatic shots, but I think Khan's wonderful performance sells the scene, and his whole story is a nice counterpoint to the other threads of the movie, which are all these about, as you said, high-level coordination between the commanders and the execution of the overall plan. It reminds us that amidst all this, the soldiers that were carrying all these plans out had a very different kind of more focused and immediate perspective, and they had their own things going on to contend with, apart from the whole high level that maybe wasn't even visible to them.
Interesting. I kind of read it differently. I like the second half in the medical tent a lot better than I like the more action-oriented scenes in the jeep. I think the jeep stuff was impressive, but I was wondering, some of the way it's staged confuses me. We have Germans shooting at Khan from what appears to be a few feet away with rifles and missing him. Yeah, that really stretched my disbelief there, because I just couldn't figure out how he possibly could have survived that. But when he gets back to the tent and his confrontation, I thought was a wonderful bit. Yeah, I guess maybe also a little unbelievable, but no one more unbelievable than him escaping an entire platoon of German troops from a few feet away.
Yeah.
And
Well, I think the idea of that one is that he surprised them and got through, but I would agree that it's a bit of a stretch, just as the scene at the tent is. I think my point is that Khan's character, his screen presence and performance is just so good that it carries you through things that might be otherwise a little artificial.
Yeah, and I think he definitely gives the strongest and most memorable performance of the movie.
Okay, well, my third favorite moment is the visceral edge-of-your-seat sequence where Robert Redford leads a charge across a river by boat into enemy territory to take a bridge from the other side, all under enemy fire. This sequence is composed of a lot of point-of-view shots with handheld cameras, so you get the perspective of someone in one of these boats. These soldiers just had to paddle furiously to get to the other side as quickly as possible in daylight, all without knowing when a bullet just might suddenly hit you because they're being fired upon as they're crossing. It's this terrific scene, very riveting and tense and well done.
That is a great action sequence. It's definitely the best action sequence in that film. But I think my other favorite sequence is a little quieter. It's a standoff between the British and German troops at Arnhem. The British troops are completely surrounded. They hold just one edge of the bridge, and the Germans are sort of firing at them. The Germans have armor divisions, which the British didn't know about going in. And so the British troops are surrounded, being led by Anthony Hopkins, and a German emissary walks out with a white flag and says, you know, hey, we got you surrounded. We're willing to discuss your surrender. And Anthony Hopkins tells his major to tell the emissary to go to hell. And there's a funny British moment where the major says, you know, we willing to take your surrender, but we just don't have anywhere to put you all as prisoners. And it's just a funny little comic moment. But it's underscored at the end when the German officer returns to his commander and the German general just says, all right, flatten Arnhem. And that's going to set up the ending sequences of the movie where the British troops are just completely besieged.
You're right. That is a great scene. So, in conclusion, A Bridge Too Far, made in 1977 and directed by Richard Attenborough, is maybe overshadowed by other classic war films such as The Longest Day, but I think it's a great story well told, and if you're interested in World War II or war movies in general, you'll almost certainly enjoy this. And I think even if you're not, but maybe you like a good suspense adventure film, or you just like watching these kinds of actors doing their thing, I think this movie is worth checking out. Well, one of the almost annoying things about movies these days is it seems like every movie's got more than one version to it. So you go to the theater to see something, you lay down your $8 or 10 or whatever it costs you. Then 3 months later, you discover you didn't see the full movie, and there's a director's cut or a special edition or an unrated version or I don't know what on DVD. And so you pick that up and you got to watch that, and then 3 months later, there's a special, special, extra special edition. Well, in a lot of cases, these don't really matter. You see one version, then you've basically gotten the experience. But our top six list for this week is going to be about movies where it's really important which cut of the movie you see. So you might see one cut of a movie and you find it to be quite terrible, whereas if you had seen another cut, you would have maybe liked it. We'll kick this off with my number six choice, which is the movie Frankenstein from 1931. And this is a movie that was cut in 1937, actually. It was a re-release that was cut by the Hays Office, which was the censor board at the time, and did not like a certain scene of violence, a great scene where the Frankenstein monster comes along a little girl throwing petals into the river, and he has an interaction with her. It's actually quite disturbing. It was deemed too disturbing for audiences of the day, and so it was cut out. And for a long time, the scene was not available. But in 1986, Universal restored not just this scene, but two others as well for release on videotape and Laserdisc at the time. And I believe versions of the movie released now all have these restorations to them. That longer cut runs 72 minutes. But actually, you know, it's not just a couple of scenes of violence here. These scenes are also very important to the character. And so you really get more of a sense of the complexity of the Frankenstein monster and the kind of inner demons he's wrestling with. So that does make a difference. You probably aren't going to see the older version by accident these days, but just in case, make sure you get the restored version.
Well, a movie that you almost certainly will see the incorrect version of by accident, well, three movies, actually. It's the Star Wars trilogy, and I think there have been more edits to these three movies than pretty much any other in the history of movies. It seems like director George Lucas is constantly tweaking them every time he releases them on a new medium or he releases them in the theater, he makes changes to them. I mean, starting with the very first time that the original Star Wars movie was re-released in the theaters before Empire Strikes Back, when they added the Episode 4 stuff to it. I mean, since then, there's been an endless number of small changes. But notably, in 1997, George Lucas released the so-called special edition of the trilogy, which he now insists is the one true version of the trilogy. You know, the changes to these movies are not that huge, and sure, everyone's seen them a lot, but they put in a bunch of CGI all over the place where it doesn't really belong. I mean, you think of the scene in the original Star Wars where they go into Mos Eisley, the little desert town in the first planet that they're on. And the original version of the film has this kind of as a Spartan world with stuff going on, and the new one has all these crazy CGI aliens and robots flitting around, and it just seems so wrong with everything else. And of course, there are also changes to the storylines. You know, Han Solo's character is entirely changed early on when he has a confrontation with the bounty hunter, where originally Han Solo just shoots the bounty hunter kind of in cold blood, and now it's in self-defense, which makes him a nicer guy but less interesting. Just tons of annoying little stupid changes. I mean, see is the oldest version of these movies that you can, because the new ones just don't do it.
Right, and I can only think of one movie that's more important to see a different cut of, so this is my number two choice, the Star Wars trilogy. The special editions, I don't object to them existing. What I object to is Lucas's suppressing of the original versions. The movies are historical documents as much as entertainment, and they say something about the times they were made in and the conditions they were made under. The original versions should exist, and fortunately we do have them sort of on DVD, not in very good editions, but, you know, hopefully we'll have a proper restoration of the original versions of the trilogies. The changes made prior to the special editions I don't think matter too much. They're pretty harmless tweaks. Well, my number five choice is a pretty long movie that was cut down for theatrical exhibition, and it's a mad, 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 mad world. It was said to be the comedy to end all comedies. They basically pack every comic star at the time into it and just have them go absolutely nuts. And it's so fun. It's not, you know, it's not witty or anything like that. It's not clever, but it's just so exuberant and energetic that you can't help but kind of have a good time with it. It doesn't really matter too much what version you see, because it's just, you know, you either get craziness or more craziness, but you might as well see the longer version, which is about 180-something minutes, depending on what source you go to. The original version was 192 minutes, and that was a roadshow version, and then it was released in 70mm after that at 162 minutes, and then a general release 35mm at 154. One of the things they chopped out wasn't plot-related at all, but they chopped out the overture and the intermission music, and that's quite nice music to have in there, and certainly in keeping with what a large production this really is. It really sets the stage for something that's theatrical and huge and everything. they've gotten all the footage that I think they have available. Some a few minutes were lost, but they've mostly restored it to the original running time, and that's the version you should see if you're going to see this at all, because otherwise, you know, what's the point? Why have less of a huge thing if you're going to have a huge of a huge thing? I don't know.
Less of a huge thing with a huge thing. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Well, I talked about Star Wars in my last entry, and I said, you know, see the original version. But I'm going to do another great movie trilogy where if you're going to watch a version, see the director's version. And that's the Lord of the Rings trilogy by director Peter Jackson. The theatrical releases of these movies were all really great, of course. I mean, everyone, I think, likes them. But I really appreciated them a lot more, strangely, when I got them home on DVD and saw these wonderful extended editions that Jackson commissioned and had done. And I mean, lots of new footage, new effects work. We really went all out on these, and especially I think the Fellowship of the Ring, the first movie, the extended edition of that, which gives you a little bit of a longer opening sequence and a little slower pace, which is surprising, but it works really well, I think. It makes the movies feel a lot more epic in scope, fleshes out some important character situations, and really just, I just really prefer them. I mean, they're really long if you watch the extended editions, but there's so much more texture and flavor to the world that I think really helps convey the depth of the source material that I really prefer the extended editions.
Yes, and again, it's this sort of thing where you have this huge epic production. Why cut it down? Why not have the full huge experience? And I agree with you about the characterization. A lot of the moments that were cut for the theatrical releases were character moments, and it's sort of nice to have the action, but the action scenes have more impact if you know the characters better and care about them more. And that was my number four choice, so I guess it's back to you.
Okay, well, my number four choice is another one where I think the director had it wrong, and this is another weird situation. We've mentioned it before, but it's the film Cinema Paradiso by director Giuseppe Tornatore. It's a fun Italian movie about growing up with the movies and about a kid who loves movies and becomes a famous film director. But the original version of the film had a whole dark element to it, a subplot that was entirely chopped out, almost entirely chopped out, by Harvey Weinstein when the film was released in America by Miramax. A lot of people objected to this. I mean, how could the distributor just chop out a large portion of the director's work to make it, you know, lighter and more palatable for American audiences? That's the sort of thing that normally we would hate. Except in this case, Weinstein was correct. The original version of the film is too dark, and there's too much stuff that happens after the real central action is over. And so cutting it out and making the movie a little lighter, it really helps actually make its point better. The melodrama stuff that gets cut out is not very good, and it really drags the movie down right toward the end. And that's, the end of the movie is where a movie has to shine, because that's what you go away with. So I think if you're going to watch a version of this movie, and both versions are available on DVD, watch the butchered version.
Yeah, and even in the butchered version, it still goes on a bit too long toward the end. The last shot is inspired. You do need that final portion of the movie. But yeah, I can't imagine that being even longer. Well, my number three choice is a movie, one of my favorite musicals, called 1776 from 1972. And it's a musical adapted from a stage play about the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And the movie was originally around 180 minutes, 170, somewhere in there. It's hard to know exactly. But it was cut down, perhaps for running time. There is a story that Nixon actually pressured the producers into cutting one of the musical numbers called Cool Considerate Men. It was sort of lampooning the right in an election year. I don't know that that story's actually true. It's hard to know whether it is or not, but certainly that song was cut from the theatrical release, along with a lot of other dialogue that happens during the debate sections when the Continental Congress is debating various issues. The theatrical version runs 142 minutes, but it was released on a Laserdisc version at 180 minutes, which is a work print. It wasn't a final version of a film. It was just sort of the theatrical version with the cutscene stuffed back in, and the edits were kind of jarring, and the picture quality was very variable. And we don't really know that the scenes that were restored for the work print were intended to be in there. But the director's cut sort of takes the best of both worlds. It takes a theatrical version, and it takes the best stuff from the Laserdisc and restores it and properly edits it into the movie for the DVD release that is actually quite recent, and it runs about 166, 168 minutes, somewhere in there. It has the restored Cool, Considerate Men number and a lot of great dialogue that was unfortunately cut, and that's the version you should see to get the full experience of this movie.
Yeah, that kind of thing. The movie goes on a little too long as it is, but
No.
Okay, well, my number three movie is another movie where I think the butchered version is correct, and that's The Big Sleep from 1946 by director Howard Hawks. The original version of this movie, as it was scripted and filmed, followed more closely the Raymond Chandler novel, but right around this time, Lorne Bacall, who co-stars with Humphrey Bogart, was really becoming a big star for the studio, and so the studio decided to reshoot it by adding in some new scenes and increasing Bacall's part to really capitalize on her upcoming success, and they wanted her to be a big star for the studio. So they added in a whole bunch more romantic scenes between her and Bogart and padded out the running time and made some changes to it so that the movie has less of a pure noir kind of gangster feel to it and more almost of a romantic drama feel to it. And strangely, that really works. Sam and I are both huge fans of Chandler and the Chandler novel. And you know, like this kind of mushy romance stuff wouldn't ever really fly in the Chandler world, but this is far and away the definitive adaptation of that book, despite all the changes, but they work. I mean, the chemistry between Bogart and Bacall is legendary. I don't know how much I need to say about it, but giving them more screen time together, that's a great idea. And, you know, both versions are available on DVD. Interesting to compare the two of them, but here's one of those rare examples where studio meddling produced a better film.
Yeah, you could have the two of them just hanging out in the backyard and taking in some sun and chatting with each other about the weather, and it would be fascinating to watch. These two actors are amazing. My number two was the Star Wars trilogy, so back to you.
I hate when you... Okay. Well, my number two is the film Blade Runner by director Ridley Scott, which is interesting. The theatrical version was not something Scott was ever very happy with. It had a whole running narration because the studio felt it was too hard to understand. Lots of changes were made from what Scott wanted, and it became one of the original films to pioneer the director's cut on home video back on the VHS days. Scott was just so not happy with the way the theatrical version had come out that he released his own director's cut. So, you know, hey, with this home video format, why not? We could release both, and the studio agreed to it, and he did it, and his version completely strips all of Harrison Ford's narrative. And it makes the movie, I think, probably a better film. Some people, there's a group of people who really do prefer the theatrical version. The theatrical version is a little bit easier to understand. It follows more closely a sort of noir template, whereas I think the director's cut is a little more metaphysical, a little stranger, a little less spelled out. I think that's a little better. And of course, the big controversy is that the director's cut leaves open the question of whether or not the main character, the Harrison Ford character, whether he is in fact a replicant, the robots that he is sent to kill. And it's kind of an interesting little debate among fans of the film whether he is or not. The director now claims that he is, but that's an impossible interpretation from the theatrical cut. So I think really in this case, probably watch both if you like the film. But definitely, I think the director's cut is a little bit more interesting, less clear. For some people, that might be a turnoff. So if you like your movies a little bit more defined, then it's cool to have the theatrical version as well.
I never understood that argument about him being a replicant. I've seen the movie, and I even saw it with that in mind. And, you know, I can see why you can fantasize about that interpretation, but I don't see where the movie supports it either. My number one choice is called Once Upon a Time in America. It was Sergio Leone's last movie, made in 1984, and he was primarily known for westerns. But his swan song was this very lyrical epic about gangsters in New York City, and if you watch the correct cut of this movie, it holds up, I think, to comparison with The Godfather and Goodfellas, though it has very much its own artistic identity, to use a pretentious turn of phrase there, but it's also a huge movie. The cut you want to see is 229 minutes long, and this was even shorter than Leone wanted it. But this cut of it was shown in Cannes in 1984 and was a smash hit with audiences and critics alike. 15-minute standing ovation at the end of it, that kind of thing. But, you know, this four-hour movie is a really tough sell for distributors, so they cut it down to 2.5 hours. So it took an hour and a half out of it. That's basically a movie right there, really. And they also rearranged a lot of scenes, too, to put it in chronological order, which, strangely, actually made it more difficult to follow. And the shortened version was a total bomb. Nobody liked it. Theatrically, it never even went wide because nobody thought it was worth seeing. One critic saw it and said it was the worst film of 1984. And years later, he saw the longer cut and called that version the best film of the 1980s. So this is a dramatic reaction, but pretty typical. And the 229-minute version was very difficult to find until very recently, 2003. A wonderful special edition DVD came out, and finally people started to realize and say, hey, you know that weird movie that came out 20 years ago? It turns out it's a masterwork. So it's one of these movies that's not even really being discovered until now. But I've seen it. It's an absolutely fantastic movie.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because I think it kind of goes along with Leone being respected more and more as time passes as a director. I think people have gone back to sort of spaghetti westerns, especially the three we did with Eastwood as really, really great works of art. Whereas at the time, I don't think they're perceived that way.
No, they were B movies of B movies. They weren't even whole B movies. They were C or D or something.
Well, my number one film is something we've talked about a lot, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but it's Touch of Evil. I'm sure Stan would have taken it if he didn't assume I was going to take it. And it's one of Orson Welles' films that was cut up by the studio out of his control and was not restored until the late 1990s when, based on a long and lengthy letter that he wrote explaining how it should be fixed, some film archivists and historians went ahead and fixed it using footage that pretty much still existed and removed all the terrible studio changes, so then what you get now is a much more interesting, complete film that has all the richness and texture that Welles originally wanted without the, you know, sort of dumbing down stuff that the studio did. And of course the studio just famously, for instance, the movie opens with a long, beautiful tracking shot, and the studio covered up with credits to keep down the running time of the film. These sorts of terrible ideas are all taken out in the extended version. Unless you really want to see how to ruin a movie, I would stay away from the original cut. It's interesting because that was a celebrated film, even with the studio release, but I think having the restored version, there's no reason to really go back and look at that original unless you're just interested in history.
100% agreement. Okay, let's recap. My number six choice for movies that what cut you see really matters is Frankenstein from 1931. My number five, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. You want the even madder version of it. Number four, The Lord of the Rings trilogy. You want the extended editions on DVD. Number three, 1776. The DVD release is far superior to the Laserdisc or the videotape versions from earlier. Number two, the Star Wars trilogy. Don't see the special editions. Number one, Once Upon a Time in America from 1984. You want the 229-minute cut.
And my top six, the Star Wars trilogy. Watch the oldest version you can find. Number five, the Lord of the Rings movies. You can watch either version, but the extended edition is superior. Number four, the American version of Cinema Paradiso is probably better. Number three, the classic version of The Big Sleep, not the director's cut, the studio release. Number two, I prefer really the director's cut of Blade Runner, but I can see the case for both versions. I don't think there's anyone who claims that either one is terrible. And number one, the Touch of Evil that was restored rather recently, not the long-standing version that was in release.
We've got another good bad movie for you, and this week's is called Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, made in 1984 by director John Guillermin, a guy who, you know, he kind of specialized in shooting movies set in Africa, good and bad. He did a couple of Tarzans. He did Death on the Nile, the Agatha Christie film, Shaft in Africa, of all things, and the King Kong remake from the 70s, and its sequel, King Kong Lives, neither of which exist. But Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, is his best worst movie. Funny for several reasons, starting with the title, because there is no jungle in this movie. Never mind, she's queen of it anyway and having a good old time swinging on vines in the middle of the African plains. Well, by the time this was made in the 1980s, jungle movies had had their prime. There's a huge fad for these jungle-set adventures in the 30s and 40s and in serials and short feature films, B-movies. And Sheena is a bit of a throwback to that, which means it's obviously about an African tribe that has a prophecy about a white woman who will become queen. Because if you go to Africa, actually all of the African tribes that are indigenous to the area, the whole continent, they all have a prophecy about a white woman who will come to them and be their queen. In this case, this is the Zamboni tribe or something like that, I don't know. And this guy has tumors all over his body, so they bury him up to his neck in the ground and they hide. And this is their healing ritual. You see, they hide behind bushes and stuff and wait for somebody to come by in a jeep and almost run the guy over. And when that happens, you know, the jeep breaks and screeches to a halt, and when that happens, everybody comes out of hiding and unburies the guy, and it turns out he's miraculously healed. And this is their healing ritual. I don't know what they do if there's no jeep in the area, but it's apparently very critical to the process, because later they perform this healing ritual again on somebody else, and again, they will not come out of hiding and unbury the guy until a jeep comes along and almost runs him over. So, you know, I wonder if a lot of people die for lack of road traffic in the deepest Africa.
I imagine that's a real problem, yeah.
Yeah. And what did they do before jeeps? They probably had to use, you know, medicine. Anyway, this white couple goes spelunking in a cave nearby where this tribe is, and their young daughter is left back in the tent. But she sneaks out in her underwear and follows them to the mouth of the cave. And mom turns around, and obviously she's very worried about her daughter because she screams her daughter's name for no known reason. Doesn't say hi, doesn't say, I thought I told you to wait in the tent. She just screams, a blood-curdling scream, in fact, and that causes a cave-in and kills them. So that, my friend, is how natural selection works in the African jungle plains. So anyway, the daughter stumbles away and grows up into Tanya Roberts, which is too bad for her, and she gets tangled up with the outside world when a journalist witnesses an assassination and is on the run, and this Zamboni woman gets framed, I think it's Zebuli or something, she gets framed for it, and so Sheena has to charge into camp on a horse, painted to look like a zebra, of course, and rescue this woman. So obviously her many elephant and chimpanzee friends are along to help her out, but this journalist named Vic chases Sheena into the wilderness. Actually, this rescue sequence has some great things about it. There's this one scene where a couple of monkeys have this gun, and they try to hold it across the way, so, you know, so the guards will trip over it. But if you watch closely, the monkeys drop the gun before the guards get to it, and the guards fall over anyway. It's one of those great things that they try to pull on you in the editing room and doesn't quite work. So most of the movie is Sheena and Vic hanging out together while the bad guys chase them for you know, highly questionable reasons. So obviously, Sheena and Vic fall in love, because that's what queens of jungles and journalists on the run do. And it's just chock full of the most idiotic nonsense. I mean, at one point, Vic kisses Sheena, and she gets all confused and says, "Mouths are used to eat with. Why did you touch yours to mine?"
Ooh, that's some quality writing.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, well, if you think about it, obviously, if you live outside of technological civilization, biological instincts don't work. It's just, I think they need electrical power.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something like that. Anyway, during this cross-country trek, they're, of course, being pursued by the bad guys, who are apparently the world's worst trackers ever, because this is a great scene here. At one point, Sheena and Vic are hiding up in a tree, and the bad guys track them to the bottom of the tree and stop there, and one of the guys said, "One of them slipped here," and the other guy says, "Did they go on?" And the tracker doesn't know. He's looking at these tracks and has no idea if Sheena and Vic are still standing in them.
That's a real stumper.
Yeah.
So the tracks just stop at the base of the tree, and then the trackers are done. Well, nowhere they could have gone. They must have teleported away.
Yeah. And the other thing is the movie also suffers from this very common cliche of machine guns firing away and not actually hitting anybody. It's a thing where, you know, Steven discussed earlier in How to Survive an Action Movie, machine guns don't actually hurt anyone, and they don't hurt anyone in this movie either. At one point, a helicopter opens fire on this whole herd of large animals packed together and somehow misses every single one of them. But anyway, by the end of the movie, everybody converges together and hangs out for a while in the midst of rampant machine gun fire, and nobody gets hurt, of course. The actors don't even act like they're dodging bullets or anything. For example, at the end, Sheena's on her painted horse and chasing after a guy in a Jeep, and they're racing along, and every once in a while, Sheena will fire some arrows at him, or he'll fire some bullets back at her, but they, you know, they don't seem too concerned about it. It's just a fun way to spend an afternoon, you know, get some exercise. And, of course, the ultimate climax involves a couple of Jeeps colliding into each other, and the whole mess goes up in a humongous ball of flame. You know, Stephen, I think vehicles would be safer in movies if people just stopped stuffing the trunks with nitroglycerin all the time. That's not very smart, is it?
Well, you need the nitro to go faster.
Oh, okay, that's what it is. Well, it also makes you die. Well, we're going to wrap up another episode, but first, of course, we have to answer this week's trivia question, which was, what star holds the record in the Guinness Book of World Records for receiving the most fan mail? Now, you've been thinking about this for the last hour or so, haven't you, Stephen?
There's so many possibilities. Let's see. It seems like it has to be someone with international appeal, right? It can't just be...
Oh, very international, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And... You know, is this sort of a trick? Is there a trick here a little
it's
bit?
It's sort of a trick because the star is not human.
Is it Mickey Mouse?
Right, exactly. I had a whole other hint planned by telling you it wasn't even a biological star. I figured you might guess Lassie if I said it wasn't human. But no, it is Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse has more fan mail than anybody.
I figured it has to be something that's been around for a while.
Yeah.
International appeal and been around for a long time. Okay.
Right. Well, good job. And anybody who's listening in, if you guess Mickey Mouse, you are right, and if you didn't, you're wrong. Well, you win some, you lose some. Well, that wraps up episode 22 for this week, and we'll be back with another episode next week. In the meantime, check out our website, allmovietalk.com. If you know the name of the website, allmovietalk.com, you know the name of the website, allmovietalk.com. And also check out rankworks.com, RANKworks.com. You think I've said this a few times before? Well, obviate the need for me. Go there and check out the number of movie-related features and other entertainment there.
And of course, we'll be back next week, Tuesday, March 6th, with another episode where we'll be looking at the films of director Billy Wilder, one of our favorite directors, the first in a multi-part segment spotlighting his career. We'll also be doing, of course, a top six list, this time on time travel movies. We did recently movies that play with time but weren't time travel movies. This is going to be more conventional time travel movies. And we're also going to be spotlighting the film Rocky, a truly great American classic that I personally feel maybe gets a little underrated when it gets compared too closely to the other movies in the series. So check back then.
Cut, 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 cut! Ugh, where's my megaphone? I need to say cut louder.